Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Evan Young, it's Here and Now. The recent surge of Taliban-led violence continues in Afghanistan. A bomb exploded near the presidential palace in Kabul today, wounding at least 10 people. And five Afghan laborers were ambushed and shot to death on their way to a U.S. military base. In response, a massive anti-Taliban campaign involving more than 10,000 Afghan and coalition forces continues in southern Afghanistan. Four British soldiers died there last week, and the commander of British forces told the BBC he might ask for additional troops. The increased violence and the type of violence, suicide bombs, roadside explosive devices, have increased fears that former Taliban members are copying techniques used by insurgents in the Iraq War. And an upcoming Newsweek magazine article paints a portrait of a vicious new Taliban leader who perhaps is mimicking the late leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Daniel Wood of the U.S. Army is Command Sergeant Major of the Combined Forces Command in Afghanistan. He oversees the American troops and joins us from Kabul. And Sergeant Major Wood, first of all, the British, as we said, are considering more troops. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has expressed concern that the violence will spread like a fire, he says. Will you also be asking for more U.S. troops as well?
Not as of right now. If we look at the enemy and their capability, it's really not that strong. The enemy doesn't have a great number of troops. Their reason that they are putting up such a fight now is because of the increased capability level of the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police.
But then we read about the leader of some of the insurgents. This is Mullah Dadullah Akhund. He's the one-legged insurgent who, in a new recruiting video for the Taliban, his followers systematically slit the throats of Afghans accused of spying for Americans and then holds their heads up. He's said to be brutal, but he also claims to have thousands of followers, including 200 suicide bombers awaiting his orders.
His desire is to terrorize people and to put fear into the hearts of the people of Afghanistan so that they'll subdue to his wishes. They just want to occupy this terrain. Now, is there an increased number? Yes, I believe that there is. Are the numbers that he's saying pretty high, a little unbelievable? Yes, I believe that is also. But with the focus of the coalition, NATO, the U.S., and the fight that we're taking to them, and the Afghan National Army, we're going wherever they are in this country. We're going to those ungoverned spaces. And bottom line is they're outmanned, they're outgunned. And I'm telling you, Robin, I don't believe that the international community will let President Karzai or the country of Afghanistan down.
What about the search for Osama bin Laden? Are U.S. forces still looking for Osama bin Laden on the border with Afghanistan and Pakistan? He just released a tape promising more attacks on the U.S., but we hear reports that the CIA has eliminated the unit that the CIA had that was hunting for Osama bin Laden. So confusing messages about whether or not the U.S. is even still looking for him.
There's a greater threat out there, and those are the terrorists that are actively involved in this country. If we were to find Osama bin Laden, that would be a great thing. But this terrorist movement is more than just one man.
Sergeant Major, you were saying that you think that the insurgent forces in Afghanistan may not be as strong as they claim to be, but their real impact is that, you know, their threat and the fear that they are imposing on people. How do you see that? Color that out for us. How do you see people feel threatened and fearful of the resurgent Taliban?
Well, the key thing is that there's a great amount of effort in building the infrastructure of this country, the roads, the schools, the mosques, the clinics. Well, we go through this country and expend a great amount of effort and international money building these things, and the Taliban come in claiming that they want the people to follow them, and they burn these schools, and they burn, they attack these mosques. They burn the clinics, and in doing so, they're causing fear in the people of Afghanistan, causing fear to they're being told if you follow the coalition or if you follow the government of Afghanistan, we'll kill you and we'll kill your family. So they're trying to get the people to follow them just out of sheer terror that they're afraid to do anything else. And that's the way they want to take control of this land. And honestly, when we speak to the people of Afghanistan, we say, what has the Taliban done for you lately? Whereas the government of Afghanistan has built these roads with the help of the international community, built these schools and clinics. So that's how they're inflicting that terror in that way.
So how do you offset that? I mean, when if people are so terrified, and if there's now, you know, we, as we understand, videos circulating of people being beheaded, you know, for cooperating at all with the new regime, how do you offset that?
We offset it by presence, getting down into those communities, getting down and sitting down with the shuras, with the local leaders and elders, and talking to them about the security, showing them ways that that they can ensure that they have security, that the towns and villages can secure themselves, and giving them a means of communication with the local police, with the closest Afghan National Army unit, or with a coalition. So it's majorly out of presence, getting out into the provinces, into the village, showing the people that there is that extension of the governance of Afghanistan.
Daniel Wood, Command Sergeant Major of Combined Forces Command in Afghanistan. And I just ask you on this, you know, 4th of July holiday, do U.S. soldiers have conversations with Afghans about what independence means, what democracy means? Or are you too busy with the day-to-day?
I was out speaking to many soldiers across the land just last week and asking them about that. And they appreciated the fact that they were seeing freedom come about on a daily or weekly basis in the lives and hearts and minds of the people here. So really this is a perfect place to remind you what our Independence Day is all about, Robert.
So, on this 4th of July holiday, a reminder of how untidy liberation can often be. And the author of a new book about the Declaration of Independence says there's a comparison between what's going on in Afghanistan and Iraq today and what was going on in the colonies back in 1776. Harvard professor David Armitage says the founding fathers were looking for a way to hold insurgent groups on this continent together, in the north, the south, and the central parts of what the Declaration would call the United States of America, so that those parts wouldn't split apart and be gobbled up by the French or the Spanish. Yes, the Declaration of Independence declared individual rights. The pursuit of happiness comes to mind. But first and foremost, it was a coming-out party for the whole United States, a grand entrance onto the international stage before the word international had even been coined. But then what? According to author David Armitage, Americans have never made a systematic attempt to trace the afterlife of what came to be called American scripture. And that's what he does in his upcoming book. It's called The Declaration of Independence, A Global History. And David, you write that what did happen next is that the Declaration was passed hand to hand, country to country, like a flame.
Remarkably, rapidly passed around the world. I've traced it from its origins on the 4th of July. Within 8 weeks, it gets as far as Warsaw and Madrid through the circuits of exchange through the Atlantic world. Incredibly fast transmission for the 18th century.
Well, give us some context for this. I mean, how unique was it?
At the time that it was written, it was the first such document. The term Declaration of Independence had never been used before. In fact, it's not even used in the document itself, though contemporaries were calling it a Declaration of Independence within days of its being written. Thomas Jefferson and his fellow authors had no templates to work with when they were producing this, so it was a totally original document.
And as we were saying, it does, you know, declare individual rights, and most Americans tend to think of it that way, is that it's about individuals. But you really make clear that first and foremost, it was about the rights of states, the United States.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's a Declaration of Independence as a birthday certificate for the United States itself, announcing their entry onto the international stage. The first paragraph doesn't begin, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." It begins, "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve its political bands and enter among the powers of the earth," that wonderful resonant phrase. The final paragraph, again, doesn't talk about individual rights. It talks about the rights of states, free and independent states, what they may of right do, which is to enter into alliances and treaties and make war and peace. That's the real structure of the document. Everything else is secondary to that.
And further, within in this time, it was just, it seems as if a time when those powers around the world were shifting from empire thinking to states thinking. Mm-hmm. Give us that context.
If you took a slice of the world in 1776 and looked around for the kinds of political bodies that most of us now live in, all of us now live in, states, you'd find relatively few of them. But across the world, you'd find great empires, the empires of the Dutch, the British, the Spanish, the French, still very much in operation in that period. The British, of course, have a huge empire spanning the globe. The rebellious colonists are trying to get out of that empire. They're trying to bring themselves onto the international stage as equals with Britain, as states, as free and independent states, 13 of them coming into a new international system on an equal footing. We think of our own moment as a great global moment, a moment of globalization, but it's not the first such moment. One of those earlier moments was around 1776. At that time, the world was being reshaped by commerce, linking together the oceans and the continents. But also across that and within that, there's a new system of states interacting with each other. The terms on which they interact with each other come to be called in this period international law, the law between sovereigns, the law between sovereign states in particular. And it's during the middle of that transformation that the colonists erupt onto the stage, and they're trying to put their statement about their entry into the world very much in these key up-to-date terms of the new norms of the international arena that they're entering into.
In fact, the very piece of paper, I don't know if you call it paper or parchment, that this was written on kind of exemplifies this new globalization. How so?
The original printing of the Declaration of Independence, which took place on the night of the 4th of July, it was issued on the 5th of July, was done by an Irishman in Philadelphia. He printed it on paper, most of which, it's been shown, was Dutch, that had been imported from England. So we have an Irishman printing this great statement of Americanness on Dutch paper. Later in the summer, when the parchment manuscript of the Declaration is signed by the delegates to the Congress, they sign it with an inkstand, also made by an Irishman, but that inkstand was made out of silver. Where does silver come from in the 18th century? Mostly from Mexico and Peru. So these two versions of the document, the printed version and the manuscript version, both give evidence of the interconnections of the Atlantic world and the exchanges of ideas and people and goods in this period.
So as we're saying, it wasn't as much a declaration of independence, in many ways it was, but it was also a declaration of interdependence, you know, the idea that we all are working together. And you started the book with a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote 50 years afterwards, in which he seems to acknowledge that. Tell us about that letter.
Just before his death in 1826, Jefferson was invited to a 50th birthday party for the U.S. in Washington, D.C. He was very ill at that point. He would die just a couple of weeks later. And he sent that letter saying that he'd love to join the party, but he couldn't be there. But nevertheless issued a statement in which he called the Declaration an instrument pregnant with our own fate and the fate of the world, and saw it as a great inspiration to others around the world who were seceding from empires.
Do you think he knew? Do you think they knew when they were crafting the document how much it would be imitated, taken from, used?
I'm sure they had no idea. Certainly the point at which they're putting it forward in July 1776 is a tense moment in the process of the American Revolution. There was no hope of success at that point. They were producing the document not least in order to get allies, military allies and financial allies, to aid the embattled American cause. It could easily have failed, and this might be lying in an archive, a British archive somewhere. Scholars might be looking for this document as the emblem of a failed secessionist revolt. There are many failed declarations of independence around the world. It might have joined those. It might not have had that inspirational force to it. It's the very success of the American cause, as much as the philosophy or the language of the document, which ensures it has a global afterlife.
And that global afterlife includes more than 100 other declarations of independence, countries like Vietnam, Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. When we come back, more with David Armitage. His book, The Declaration of Independence, A Global History, comes out next January, but we're getting a sneak peek on this fourth. More coming up here now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And on this 4th of July, we're taking a fresh look at the Declaration of Independence with Harvard history professor David Armitage, author of the upcoming book, The Declaration of Independence, A Global History. And we want to talk about the other countries who modeled their own declarations of independence on the words of Thomas Jefferson. How often do you see it repeated and copied?
If you look around world history since 1776, you can find more than 100. I've got about 120, 130 examples of declarations of independence, many successful, some failed. And of the 192 states that are now represented at the United Nations, more than half of them have a document that they themselves recognize as a declaration of independence. Quite a lot of those documents took language and structure from the American Declaration itself. Quite a lot of them develop variations around the idea of a Declaration of Independence, not necessarily looking specifically back to the American Declaration itself. In the book, I call this the beginning of a genre, the beginning of a template, an idea which other people can take up, whether consciously or unconsciously, from the American example to announce their entry onto the world stage, to give their birth certificate.
I'm looking at the Venezuelan Declaration of Independence, 1811. It's got an opening paragraph that names the states of Venezuela, and then it says, "We deem it unnecessary to insist upon the unquestionable right which every conquered country possesses to restore itself to liberty and independence." That seems to resonate with the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one. I was reading Vietnam's. It's also beautifully written, but it's a litany of harms.
Mm-hmm.
And that directly goes to the American Declaration of Independence as well. Americans forget that there is a section in ours, too, that sort of says how we felt we were harmed.
Today, the Declaration of Independence will be read around the country. Most people probably switch off for three-quarters of that reading because it's the list of the charges against King George III in the middle of the document, the specific charges against him. And many subsequent declarations of independence take up that very same structure. They take a set of damages, harms, grievances against often colonial masters, and the Vietnamese example is a very good one. Ho Chi Minh, who wrote that document, was a great admirer of George Washington, and when he was writing the document, he got a translation to make sure that he was quoting it correctly, and in fact, the very opening lines of that Vietnamese declaration come straight from the American one.
Here's the opening line. "All men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." This is in the Vietnam Declaration of Independence, and then further down, they list the grievances. For more than 80 years, the French imperialists, abusing their liberty, equality, and fraternity, have violated the land of our ancestors. That's literally acknowledging the Declaration of Independence of the U.S. Where else do you see it, acknowledged, maybe not as straight out?
You can see it in places where American influence had an important impact, for instance, in Liberia in the 1840s.
Which was founded by American freed slaves.
Exactly, and their Declaration of Independence follows the structure of the American Declaration and a lot of its language as well. My favorite example is one that casts some interesting light back on the American document, and that's the Unilateral Declaration of Independence of Southern Rhodesia in 1965, a case where a minority white government in southern Rhodesia proclaimed its independence in order that it would not have to follow the directives of the British government in order not least to democratize its political system. They declared independence not of the crown, unlike the Americans, but of the British government and its control. And they took, the structure and the language of the American Declaration to make their own entry into the world on the same kinds of terms as the Americans, using American language, but for very different reasons, and certainly omitting entirely any reference to equality. Quality,
right.
Liberty, or the pursuit of happiness there.
But it begins, "Whereas in the course of human affairs, history has shown that it may become necessary for a people to resolve the political affiliation which have connected them with another people."
Mm-hmm.
So, sort of can't argue with that, except, as you said, a very different situation. And you do say that's one of the problems of the Declaration of Independence, that it was the independence of the states. But then problems can arise when perhaps within those independent states, indigenous peoples also want their independence.
There are really two messages in the Declaration of Independence. One is about the right of states to exist alongside other states. The second set of messages is the one that's obviously much more important to individual Americans, which is the description of the rights of individuals, the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those two things obviously can come into tension with each other when certain groups find that the rights of states are trampling on their own individual rights, and it's certainly been one of the key features of the modern world that states that have declared their independence ever after refuse independence to any other internal groups. There are very, very few examples of independent states allowing any part of their territory or any group within their territory to break away and set up an independent state.
Which, of course, brings us to the phrase, "All men are created equal." Tomorrow, we're going to hear more about how, during the Revolution, many black slaves chose to fight on the side of the British because the British promised them individual freedom, which, you know, they wouldn't have if the colonies won. So the idea of liberating blacks was percolating at the time. But you say the crafters of the Declaration were remarkably forward-thinking in putting that phrase in, not for immediate use because they knew it would be too soon, but for future use.
Absolutely. And certainly the very fact that the document incorporated those individual rights allowed particularly British critics of it to accuse the American colonists of utter hypocrisy. There's one commentator in 1776 who said there's no sight more appalling than a slave-driving American colonist whipping his slaves while also writing declarations of independency, putting into a document these rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness while also denying it to hundreds of thousands of human beings in the colonies themselves. That remains one of the great paradoxes of the American Revolution, and it's there behind the document itself.
Do you have a favorite phrase?
I think it might be from the very opening paragraph where the authors of the Declaration address themselves to the opinions of mankind. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they, the colonists, should declare the causes which impel them to their separation. I think that sense of a decent respect for the rest of the world, a necessity of entering into equal terms, into a dialogue with the rest of the world, is perhaps a message that we can still take from the Declaration of Independence today.
Yeah. And also, as you write, that they were conveying to the British, we were enemies, but we will be friends.
Or, if you treat us like enemies, we will treat you like enemies. In war, enemies; in peace, friends. They're very clear in the document about the new terms on which they're going to treat their former masters, but they're now equals in the international sphere.
Harvard professor David Armitage, author of the upcoming book, The Declaration of Independence, A Global History. It will be published next January. And tomorrow on Here and Now, another story from the Revolutionary War. As we said, how African Americans, well, actually black slaves, fought for their freedom on the British side. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's much more ahead Here and Now. Young, it's Here and Now. Ah, the grill. About 68 million Americans plan to enjoy a barbecue this 4th. Americans bought 15 million grills last year, many the high-end stainless steel gas grills that fire up with a push of a button. But luxury grills? That's nothing. There's a backyard revolution going on. Entire outdoor kitchens costing hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And when you walk inside, the first thing you'll see on the left is my grill, big deep sink, and an outdoor refrigerator. And on the right-hand side, we have a big buffet table made of marble. We have to take that in the winter so it won't crack. And facing us is my spa pool, which I call my mini swimming pool.
That's Boston area chef Stephanie Sokolov. We'll go on a complete tour of her outdoor sanctuary in a moment. But first, Ann Dickoff is author of the upcoming book, Outdoor Rooms 2. She joins us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. And Ann, for those of us who are still trying to just get, you know, a pillow on the chaise lounge, this is amazing.
It is amazing. Looking through all of the hundreds of pictures that I sifted through, I kept thinking about Hearst Castle with its sparkling pool and imported statues and giant neoclassical pavilions. But it turns out that there are plenty of normal people building shrines in their backyards.
Well, but expensive ones. According to Consumer Reports, let's get some numbers. An outdoor room is the second most likely home remodeling project. About 1.2 million U.S. homes are going to have a fully functional outdoor kitchen.
That's right. A basic outdoor kitchen can start around $3,000, but it's pretty common for them to go up to about $100,000 when you add professional-grade appliances and amenities like custom cabinets, beverage centers, sinks, high-end finishes like stainless steel and granite, and then you have the mood-enhancing landscaping, which can include water features, fire features. The sky's the limit.
The appliances are one thing, but you're talking now in just the things you've listed: power, gas, water. You might need a sewer hookup. And that's all before you even start. And then I'm looking at some of these appliances. A $10,000 barbecue, an 84-inch model.
There's a trend recently towards home life and family and entertaining. The new buzzword is hiving, they call it. People are trying to make their homes into exotic places that create social connection. They're staying home instead of going on vacation, but they're also trying to bring the vacation home.
Some people say this is a post 9/11 phenomenon, but then it seems to, it almost seems to get out of control at a certain point. I mean, it's one thing to get a large grill and then to decide maybe you want, you know, some sort of cooler. But what, you know, what are some of the other things that this can lead to?
people are using high-end furniture, teak dining sets, bar stools, easy chairs.
Is there anything that you've seen in your research that, you know, even you had to say, this is just going too far?
One of the spaces that I've seen has a detached kitchen island overlooking the swimming pool. You can swim up to the edge of the counter, and there's a kind of an underwater bar with a waterfall pouring over the edge.
I don't think I've ever been to a hotel that nice, although I've heard about them. Before we let you go, it does seem as if these outdoor rooms are really outdoor kitchens for the most part, but are people, you know, extending it in other ways?
Absolutely, they are. I have seen outdoor bedrooms. Adults are building their own tree houses, even making spaces inside the house open up to the outside through walls that fold away. There was an outdoor bathroom.
And how does that work?
It's inside the house, but then the walls fold away to make the bathroom a part of the exterior courtyard. And the bathtub is parallel to the swimming pool, so it makes bathing kind of a ritual.
And the rest of us just do it to get clean. Anne Dickoff is author of the upcoming book, Outdoor Rooms 2. She spoke to us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Anne, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, Boston restaurateur Stephanie Sokolov of Stephanie's on Newbury invited Here Now's Kevin Sullivan on a tour of her backyard, starting with her gas-powered outdoor pizza oven.
The oven goes up to like 650, 700 degrees. So pizzas take about 5-6 minutes. And they come out really great because the bottom is really crisp and the cheese is really melty and gooey. I got a Viking 48-inch grill outside. I think they make a great piece of equipment. They're really hot, and I think, why not, right?
It's pretty impressive. It's stainless steel. Why did you go for this whole look, you know, the granite and the stainless steel?
I spend a lot of time in California. I have a daughter who lives out there, and they do all sorts of outdoor living. And because of that, and I've seen so much, I was determined. It's fun, and we use it all the time when the weather is seasonable. And I love the way it looks and feels. It's another living room, or another kitchen, really.
Why do you think people are investing their money this way?
I think real estate is really valuable. And I think that people like to entertain. I think a lot of people are staying home. And how many years have we been doing barbecues, you know? And this is just a fancy way of doing a barbecue.
I mean, very fancy. What's the ballpark on a place like this?
Don't even know. Don't even want to guess. I really do know. A lot. A lot. It really is. More than I ever anticipated. And you have to be ready to go there.
So why don't you just tell me about some of the parties you might have out here? I mean, it looks like you can have a great time.
We always have a great time. We've had family parties, of course. I've had staff parties, just some friends over. And of course, my daughter and I love going in the whirlpool at night. And we keep it at a really nice temperature. Let's feel it. And that was the very first thing I wanted in here, because I thought it would just be a really nice element at the end of the day to come and relax.
Can we turn it on?
Yeah, we can turn it on. And we made it fairly sizable, so this is what I call my mini pool. The few special elements about this one is, A, the size, it's 8 by 12, and the wall of the spa has a big lion's head in the center, two medallions on either side, and water that comes out of their mouths. I did that partly in humor and partly because I just think it's beautiful.
A little kind of kitschy.
It is kitschy. I liked it, though.
Do you ever feel like this giant grill, the stove, the pizza oven, you know, maybe it's a little over the top?
You know, I would say maybe, except it's what I do for a living. I cook, I'm a chef, I own a restaurant, I was in the catering business for 20 years. So for me, in my life, it's not over the top.
I read something that said that this is sort of tapping into our Cadillac desires.
That's an interesting way of putting it. I get that. I think that's probably true. Because I think it feels like a luxury item. And I understand that.
What's your advice on the perfect hamburger?
Do not press it. Do not. All the juices come out. Really, start it on one side. Wait till you see the juices coming up through the top, then flip it over, and that's it. Give it the time it needs, and don't squish it. For God's sakes, it gets all the juices out.
Whatever you do, don't squish it. Expert advice for your July 4th grilling from Boston area chef Stephanie Sokolov. Talking here now is Kevin Sullivan. And as to the backyard, as members of Aerosmith will say when they sing tonight with the Boston Pops here in Boston, dream on. Still to come, they were the rock stars of the revolution. A new children's book brings the founding fathers to life as little boys. You're listening to Here and Now. So, looking for an out-of-the-way bistro in Paris, perhaps a romantic spot to watch the sunset in Hawaii, or maybe the most extreme surfing in Bali? Well, now there's a way to connect with other travelers who've blazed the trail before you. The latest trend in travel websites lets people share their travel experiences with one another, taking a page from MySpace and other social networking sites to connect millions of travelers around the globe. Khalil Sakakini is travel editor for GoTravelUpdates.com. He's been monitoring these websites and joins us with more. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm on line with one. It's TripAdvisor.com. That's pretty much the most popular one, isn't it?
Yeah, that's sort of a biggie. It's the granddaddy of sort of community-oriented websites. It's changed the way people approach travel on the web.
It says unbiased reviews of hotels, resorts, and vacations. And right on the front page, the moment I'm looking at it, it's got rants and raves, and there's a thumb down for the Days Suites Main Gate East at Walt
right.
Disney World Resort, but a thumbs up for Hotel Essentia in the Yucatan Peninsula. And there seems like so much more here. So tell us more about how the site works.
Used to be, let's say, some of the big guys, Expedia, Orbitz, Travelocity, they would rate a resort, rate a destination, 1-5 stars, whatever. What TripAdvisor does, it gives real people the opportunity to make real comments, seeing a destination, seeing a resort as you and I would.
Right. For instance, the person who did not like the Days Suites Main Gate East writes, "We were greeted by rude staff and roaches. We left immediately and horrified." But that brings up a question. Who vets this?
Yeah, that's the rub, because one person's miserable experience or rude staff could be another person's great experience and a terrific staff. And that's where the problem is. The credibility is in question. A lot of disgruntled employees might write in. A competitor might write in. So you're getting a range of opinions. And A, you don't know where they're coming from. And B, you don't know what a person means.
Right. And we should add to what you said that TripAdvisor, for instance, does say that they have this kind of software that can find slanted material, favorable or unfavorable, from travel industry insiders, so that someone can't get in there from a hotel and try to, you know, tip it in their favor. But they also say that if, in fact, something gets through that maybe isn't, you know, really true about a place, that so many people will flock to it that they will balance it out.
You know, maybe. I just printed up a comment from on TripAdvisor.com relative to an inn in Massachusetts. And I know the inn personally, and I read the review, and one person said there was rat-infested and filthy. And that's not the case. And then I read somebody else's review that said, how could you believe this? It's completely untrue. So mm-hmm. he left saying, okay, what do I believe? And how much of this do I want to go through in order to arrive at some truth, whatever that truth is?
Well, some of the other websites have said the way that it works is you get the preponderance of response, you know. And by the way, what are some of the other websites that you found?
I like TripConnect.com. I like the dialogue, the sense of people talking to each other. Okay, Joe, you're going to Puerto Rico. Where do you want to stay? Well, I think we should stay at such and such place. So there is a kind of dialogue feeling. That's TripConnect.com. I like that. Yahoo Answers is good. You get a free answer when you type in a question.
The whole trend is called Travel 2.0. And another site is called Faircast. This is still in the testing phase, but they're going to give advice on the best time to buy a ticket.
That's fun. I mean, that's sort of like predictive technology. It's like playing the stock market. So they will tell you the trip from Boston to Chicago or Chicago to San Francisco, we think, is going to go up by $18, and we met 77% sure that that's going to happen. And here's the website or the link to go to it. And it's predictive technology. It's in a beta testing process, but I think it's a great idea, and at least it's fun.
Yeah, you click on and you can see when they think that the fares are going to drop
right.
and buy at that time.
And what the likelihood is.
Right. So well, and before we let you go, Khalil, we understand that online travel booking has dropped, actually.
There are some reports that say that's the case. We're not sure whether it's because of the economy is suffering, the gas prices are exorbitant. or whether people just are finding that they're looking online and booking with an agent because the websites have gotten very clever and have created real-life people behind desks now mm-hmm. that answer questions. So I just looked for fares on a seller to New York, but finally I booked through the agent. And while it may have cost me a few bucks more, in this case it didn't, in some cases, it's simpler, Robin.
And maybe it's more of a sense of security in kind of uneasy times to actually talk to a human.
I think we want to talk to people.
Yeah. Khalil Sakakini, travel editor for GoTravelUpdates.com. Khalil, thanks so much.
Yeah, my pleasure, always.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now. Before the founding fathers were the founding fathers, they were little boys, and boy, were they a handful. That's the premise of a new children's book, John, Paul, George, and Ringo. Really, did you know that Ben Franklin was often called Ringo by his friends? Kidding. In fact, there's a lot of kidding for kids in this new tongue-in-cheek tribute to the movers and shakers of the American Revolution, the Beatles of their day, John, Paul, George, and Ben. The book is written and drawn by Lane Smith, who previously illustrated The Stinky Cheese Man and other Fairly Stupid Tales, and a personal favorite, James and the Giant Peach. And Lane Smith joins us now from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Well, let's start with who's who in the title. John Hancock, of course. Paul Revere.
George Washington. Ben Franklin. And then for good measure, I threw Thomas Jefferson in there, but he was so independent, he didn't make the title cut.
That's right. And besides, it would have thrown off the whole Beatle thing, which,
exactly.
You know, you play throughout the book. The picture on the first page, you have the four lads crossing from left to right, looking as if they were on the Abbey Road cover.
That's right.
Paul has bare feet. Paul Revere has bare feet. Of course, who had bare feet in the Abbey Road cover?
Paul.
Mm-hmm.
You'll notice I replaced his cigarette with a little candy, an 18th century
right.
candy.
Oh, right, you did. Why the Beatle references, by the way?
You know, it really wasn't a calculated plan. I had been working on various stories, and I just had them laid out on my desk that way one day, and the titles were John, Paul, George. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I've got to use that.
Yeah.
And then just a few things fell into place, like Say You Want a Revolution. I kept them mercifully to a minimum, the Beatles puns.
Let's go through the lads. You have John Hancock. As
right.
a boy who, in school, he was always writing his name too big.
At the beginning of the school year, they're all asked to write their names on the chalkboard. And when John scrawls his massive John Hancock, the teacher says, we don't need to read it from space.
And then there's Paul Revere, who
yep.
really did. Now, you have a fact checker in the back of the book, a true and false, and he really did play in a bell-ringing club.
That's right. In the Old North Church, the very same Old North Church where years later the two of by sea lanterns were lit.
But is it true that Paul Revere yelled a lot?
We don't know for sure, but you try ringing bells nonstop for hours and see how you talk.
If you could read to us from the section on Paul, young Paul Revere, we learned that he was in a bell-ringing club and his head was filled with bings and bongs and mm-hmm. he had a scream just to hear himself talk. And then he goes to work at the Revere shop. Would you mind starting there where he's waiting on his customers?
Okay. There's a customer, a rather rotund customer, inquiring about her order. So we hear Paul say, extra large underwear? Sure, we have some. Let's see. Large, large, extra large. Here they are, great, big, extra large underwear.
She's mortified.
She is. And Paul was like a bullhorn in a china shop. To another customer, he's saying, your wig? Yes, it's coming. And your polka dot shirts are coming. And the pink breeches are coming. And then we see a spread of him as an adult. And the line says, it took many years and a midnight ride for people to finally appreciate this special talent. The redcoats are coming! The redcoats are coming! Everyone except that big underwear lady, she was still mad.
Now, when you do readings for kids, you use a bullhorn for that section?
I do. I start out by yelling and I say, no, he was even louder than that, and I pull the bullhorn out.
Well, and then we have the section on George Washington. You retell the story of how he confessed to his father that he chopped down this cherry tree, and his father said, then run to my arms, dearest boy, for you have paid me for it 1,000-fold with your honesty. And then you turn the page and George says, really, in that case, when I tell you I've taken out the apple orchard, leveled the barn, and made kindling of your carriage, you'll be a wealthy, wealthy man.
He was, you know, just an honest lad.
By the way, do we know if the cherry tree story is true?
the cherry tree story is not true. And that was kind of the starting point for me to do this book and to take liberties, if you will, with the tells, because Mason Parson Weems wrote that tell years ago to teach kids about honesty, which is hilarious because he made the whole story up.
And you embellish on it.
Exactly.
We come to the Ringo portion of the band. There's Ben Franklin, who really annoyed people with all his sayings, apparently.
That's right. And he's, even at the age of 8 or 9, he's got an unfortunate receding hairline already.
So he considered it his duty to provide frequent free advice. The sleeping fox catches no poultry, he tells someone. Those who in quarrels interpose must often wipe a bloody nose, to someone else. Annoying.
Yeah. The townsfolk were so taken by his generosity, they came up with a saying especially for Ben. They're all telling him to please shut his big yap.
And the fifth, is it the Pete Best of this group, is Thomas Jefferson, an independent lad. How so?
He was always doing the opposite of what his classmates wanted him to do. For instance, when the class was making birdhouses by gluing macaroni to ye old balsa wood, Tom happily ignored them and used traditional building materials in a neoclassical design. And we see him building a sort of a mini version of Monticello. And it eventually catches up with him because the instructor pulls him aside and tells him he can enjoy all the life, liberty, and happiness he wants independently in the corner. And the other students, they pursue lunch.
Your conclusion, after introducing us to all of the characters, and the conclusion that you're trying to impart to kids is that these qualities that made these little boys perhaps annoying at times, you know, were what made them, you know, the right people to have at a revolution.
Exactly. I think I wanted to give hope to those knucklehead kids, of which I was one, that at the start of the revolution, of course, Paul Revere grew up to be a noisy man, so he was the perfect guy to do the midnight ride. And Jefferson, as an independent kid, grew up to be an independent man, so who better to write the Declaration of Independence? And, you know, Franklin was a clever man, and in fact, when they were signing the document, he quipped, "We must all hang together, or assuredly we shall all hang separately." Mm-hmm. That kind of lightened the mood there. And John Hancock, a bold man, he was the first to scribble his autograph. And then, of course, Honest George. They all wanted him to be king. You know, he thought, we don't need another King George. But in my book, he says, President George, however, has a nice ring to it.
And in the end, just in case parents get worried, you set the record straight with ye olde true or false section, including, you know, all of Ben's sayings in this book were actually Ben's sayings. True. They were from his Poor mm-hmm. Richard's Almanac. Oh, but here's one I love. But on that night of April 18th, 1775, Paul shouted, "The British are coming." False. As you
That's
write,
right.
Back then Americans considered themselves British. That would be like saying, "We are coming."
And that sounds pretty silly. Most historians think they probably said the regulars are coming, or, you know, the redcoats are coming, the lobster backs are coming, but probably not the British are coming.
This is children's book author Lane Smith on his lighthearted and somewhat but not entirely true take on the Founding Fathers when they were kids. The book is called John, Paul, George, and Ben. Lane Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was fun.
Well, that's our program for this July 4th. Now, you all just go on out and have a wonderful day. Okay, go on now. Bye-bye. What am I thinking? We're here in Boston where it's almost against the law not to play this song on this day. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please have a safe, fun, thoughtful 4th and join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.